Don, thank you very much. And my friends, it's, I suppose, a pleasure to be here, although when you reach the status of being regarded as a primary source on events a half century back, you know that you've gotten old. 1968 is, I think, rightly regarded as a watershed year, and Don spoke a minute ago to some of its significance, perhaps not quite in the same class as 1865 or 1945, but on a par for drama and trauma with perhaps 2001, and significant especially for its political events. The invasion of Czechoslovakia by the USSR as a turning point in the psychology of the Cold War, as well as the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy, the Chicago Democratic National Convention in August, and the election of Richard Nixon in November, a set of events which served as harbingers of the death of the New Deal and the Great Society's liberalism, including for many our implicit faith in the moral leadership qualities of our country, the United States. It was, as I learned much later from my economic research, a year of minimum inequality in the American economy, of maximum prosperity, full employment, peak war, and growing, if not yet quite maximal, discontent. It was also a year, to speak personally, of my family situation, in which my father's largest book, The New Industrial State, was on the bestseller list for practically the entire year. For me, 1968 was a coming-of-age year. I was 16 years old. I turned 16 actually on January 29th, which was January 30th in Saigon. And the event was marked by the North Vietnamese Army, the National Liberation Front, by the start of the Tet Offensive. I was what was called a lower middle, everywhere else a sophomore in high school, in my case at Phillips Academy, Andover, Massachusetts, an approximate classmate of the future governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, who I did not know, although I do have a memory of having been herded into an assembly sometime the previous fall to hear a reedy-voiced congressman from Houston, and of thinking of not only, first of all, how unimpressive I thought he was, but also that he must have a kid around the place somewhere. So why would anybody have invited him to speak at Andover? It was also a year of, and a fall, of anti-war rumblings. On a weekend home in late 1967, I went with my father out to Logan Airport in Boston to meet a United States Senator, Eugene McCarthy, who was contemplating a challenge against the President, Lyndon Johnson, in the primaries of the following spring. And it was in my parents' living room later that evening, so far as I recall, that we were first told that McCarthy would, in fact, make the run. Whether that was news or only news to me at that moment is unclear in my memory now, but it was an event very close to the moment when McCarthy's campaign began. In early February, to bring the story up into 1968, came the stunning news of Eugene McCarthy's near victory, 40% of the vote, against Lyndon Johnson in the New Hampshire primary campaign. And by some magical arrangement, no doubt engineered by my father, I, in early March or mid-March, flew out to Madison, Wisconsin for the spring break, plus a few extra days, to volunteer for the McCarthy Crusade. I was therefore, as you can see from the photograph I showed a minute ago, one of the clean for Gene. We were flooded with volunteers, and my task was to organize them into small groups. Madison proper had been saturated with canvassers, and so my task was to send them out to the villages of Dane County in the immediate surround. It was definitely McCarthy country. One volunteer came back and reported that at one door, an elderly gentleman who had some difficulty responding to the doorbell had come up and taken a flyer, and he'd said, "Well, we haven't heard from Senator McCarthy for some time now, but if he's running, we're sure going to vote for him." I instructed my volunteer that if that ever happened again, to be sure to remind them that Senator McCarthy was running in the Democratic primary on this occasion. One night, I was tasked to deliver the candidate's speech to him personally before a rally in Milwaukee, and this involved being airlifted in a small Cessna down to the rally and making a heroic entry to the candidate's dressing room, where I was disappointed to discover that he already had a copy of his speech and my trip was entirely unnecessary. He was, of course, very nice about it. The crowd was delirious. And he closed, as he often did, with Walt Whitman's Poets to Come, Artists to Come, "Awake, for You Must Answer." I was in Wisconsin and returning from canvassing in the small town Spring Green, the hometown of Frank Lloyd Wright, as I recall, as we listened to President Johnson's speech of March 31st, that he would not seek nor would he accept the nomination of his party for another term as president. I am not now especially proud of what I said to Swedish television the next day, but so far as I know, there's no record of it, and I'm not going to repeat it before you hear. April, May, and early June were dark and unfathomable months. The murder of Martin Luther King touched even our cloistered enclave at boarding school as our black student colleagues staged a reproachful sit-down strike, eloquent and silent statement of the gravity of that moment. And there were the deep and bitter and entirely pointless divisions between McCarthy's partisans and those of Robert F. Kennedy. It was a moment of lift that we felt when McCarthy bested Kennedy in Oregon, an event which was largely due to the peculiar racial demographics of that state, which I was unaware of at the time. And then Kennedy's victory in the California primary and the crushing news of his assassination on June 5th, 1968. I have a little personal memento here from that time or a little earlier. It reads, "For Jamie," and I can't see it on my computer screen here, so I'll come out, "with warmest regards to you and more importantly than your father, may you have the personality and sense of humor of your mother." I learned much later that one of Bobby's aides, possibly it was Frank Mankiewicz, I think it was in fact Frank Mankiewicz, had telegraphed my father, or telephoned, as the votes came in, with a message asking if he was now ready to bring the McCarthy forces over into the Kennedy camp to consolidate the anti-war movement into a single political force. That was just minutes before the shots in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel, and the game was up. But for me, as my school year ended, and I prepared to abandon Andover, which I did not especially like, for me, the year was only about to begin. Now, for a teenager of that period, I was fairly well-traveled, but I'd never gone anywhere outside the country anyway, entirely on my own and unsupervised, until one day my father said, "You know, the most interesting place in the world right now is Prague. You should go and have a look." And so, equipped with a visa and a voucher for a week in a Prague hotel, off I went. The plan was to meet my father back in Zurich and go on to Israel, where he had arranged for me to join for 3 weeks an international youth camp at Haifa. Prague was very definitely exciting. You could sense the exhilaration of free speech. Even I could sense it, although I spent more than half of my time looking at buildings and the slides, which I retained and which were unfortunately wrecked by the passage of time, as I discovered yesterday when I was looking at them, are largely architectural rather than political in character. It was also that spring a magnet for the clueless, of which I was definitely a prime example. But in between the bouts of pure tourism, and I do remember walking amongst the exposed skeletons in the vault at the basement of the Prague Cathedral, and disappointing the many black market money changers who were looking for dollars on Charles Square, I made efforts to contact what I imagined would be a student organization. I only found one. It was up a dark staircase when somewhere which was festooned with pro-Viet Cong posters and playing American protest folk songs. And I'm fairly sure now it was not indigenous to Czechoslovakia, but rather an offshoot of the Komsomol or the Comintern. I didn't stay there very long. Eventually, I do remember engaging a university student who indulged me with a briefing on the rise of Alexander Dubček, which, apart from his patient attitude and, I suppose, pleasure that someone so young and, generally speaking, new to the business of world politics as I was interested in these events, but apart from that, I retained relatively little. Still, one could not fail to notice the mood. It was a revolutionary effervescence. You could feel it in the streets, the way people walked, the way people talked, a general sense of motion. And I've only seen this and experienced it on two further occasions. Once was in Lisbon in April of 1975, just before the constitutional referendum 1 year after the revolution, the Carnation Revolution in 1974. And the other was much more recently in Athens in the spring of 2015, when the left government was elected to defy for 4 or 5 months the coalition of its creditors. And I had been there. So I suppose I can say that I had seen what socialism with a human face meant while it was very briefly underway. Something like that does leave an impression even after 50 years. The small tent city outside Haifa, to which I went next, was surely constructed as an international goodwill and even propaganda exercise. And it's probably unreadable, but there's an itinerary of our visit to Jerusalem in early August of 1968. But this was the fact that it was, in fact, there for, let's say, international public relations purposes was not terribly apparent to teenagers who, of course, given what had happened in 1967, already viewed Israel through the prism of our idealism and that state's own historical narrative. And we were, anyway, in my case, a just released inmate, ex-inmate of an all-boys prison, and this was, after all, the summer camp. I do remember the exceptional sight of women soldiers, something I had not previously seen, but also how in East Jerusalem, the resident Arabs would turn their heads and simply not look in our direction. At the Knesset, the event which is marked on this calendar, I did ask a parliamentarian, I cannot now remember who, whether the moment of triumph wasn't also the moment to make peace, and got for an answer a look that prefigured what would come and that indicated quite firmly that I had not asked a question that was welcome at the time. And on the way out of Israel, I suffered an attack of flu or some other 3 or 4 day illness that put me for some days in the care of the keepers of the Baha'i Shrine in Haifa, former Iranian diplomats whose children had been classmates in India in the early 1960s, and I would meet them again over 40 years later in Vancouver, long since exiled from the Islamic Revolution and Republic. I returned home via London, landed at Heathrow, not having bathed in hot water for 3 weeks. I had a rash on my skin. I had a small suitcase with one lock that was broken and an uncured sheepskin jacket from the bazaar in East Jerusalem stuffed into a rubberized olive green sack that in those days was called the Harvard book bag. The officer took my landing card and queried, "What's this address, 11 Downing Street?" I replied, "It's the home of the Chancellor of the Exchequer." "And you're staying there, are you?" I said, "Yes." "And do you know the Chancellor?" I said, "No, but I know his wife." "And where did you meet Mrs. Jenkins?" I said, "On my parents' farm in Vermont." "And are the Jenkins at home?" I said, "No, they're vacationing in Cyprus, but they said I could use their flat while I was in London." "I see. Would you mind waiting here?" At this point, immigration to Her Majesty's realms stopped. This was not a situation, this was a democratic United Kingdom, this was not a situation where you called a supervisor. In fact, all of the officers came off of their post and formed a circle, and I saw my passport going around from hand to hand. They looked over at me. Eventually, a light went on, and one officer approached, "You wouldn't be by any chance," I said, "Yes, I am." "Oh, do go right on through. Terribly sorry, but we get visitors from time to time coming in with rucksacks saying they're spending the weekend at Buckingham Palace." You see the evidence that I did, in fact, stay at the Chancellor's flat at number 11 Downing Street. In front of number 10, there was a single bobby, obviously unarmed. The Italian staff took me in, fed me pasta, and I spent 3 days lounging in bathtubs that I could stretch out in. And during those 3 days, the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia. So, and on that last morning, as I was heading out to the airport, the cabinet was called for an emergency session. So the black cars started pulling up in front of number 10. And I have some photographs which are now practically invisible, but which capture the mood of a small crowd that gathered in front of number 10. And you could see, I think, the faces of the Blitz on people's expressions there. Dead calm, very somber. I flew home. And my father took a look at me and, of course, told me to clean up. By that time, I was already pretty clean. But anyway, to repack, we're going to Chicago. And so we did, and on the street lamps outside the Chicago Hilton at Grant Park, there were fresh hand-lettered signs that said, "Welcome to Prague." Once in Chicago, My father disappeared. He said it was to a club, if I recall rightly. Actually, I don't know where he went. I did not see very much of him during those days. And he left me in possession of a suite, a two-room suite, on the 14th floor, which was the McCarthy headquarters floor of the Chicago Hilton, which over two or three days turned into a common room and crash pad for the campaign staff. From there, on the second night, I watched the National Guard arrive in a long column of jeeps to relieve the police facing off against the protesters in the park below. While at the same time, the Chicago police were cracking yippie heads at Lincoln Park. The next day, I went to the convention itself, and among other things, to hear the nominating speeches. I should, so this is a, just a note showing that I was going to Chicago and also that I had a somewhat slight romantic association there. On the next day, I went to the convention itself, among other things, to hear the nominating speeches, including my father, who gave the seconding speech for Gene McCarthy. It was brushed off of national television by the police riot at Grant Park to the chants, long remembered thereafter, of "the whole world is watching." When the vote came, the galleries, which had been occupied by a very small number of McCarthy and McGovern volunteers and staff, were filled up with Chicago city workers who were festooned in Humphrey buttons and hats. I don't think they were there out of pure enthusiasm. It was, after all, Mayor Daley's Chicago. I remember the dignity with which the Wisconsin delegation, which I had an emotional connection to, cast its vote, and then it was over. Afterwards, the defeated gathered to hear Allard Lowenstein and Jesse Jackson. And we boarded buses to within a few blocks of Grant Park, marching there by candlelight to join the protesters. By that time, the police violence had abated, and we were singing the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which is one of the few songs whose tune and complete lyrics I could ever sing. At least I thought I could at that time. And the next morning, my father collected me, and we left. At some point, possibly earlier that morning, he'd mounted the stage to speak to the protesters in Grant Park, surrounded by guardsmen with their rifles at the ready. He turned to the crowd. He said, don't go trying conclusions with those young men over there. They're draft dodgers just like you. As he left the stage, a young sergeant came up to him, and he had a rare moment of self-doubt. This was not something my father had very often. But the sergeant put out his hand, said, "Sir, I just want to shake your hand. That's the nicest thing anyone has said about us all day." So we left. And afterwards, actually the following morning, the police raided the McCarthy headquarters at the Hilton and beat up a room full of staff and volunteers, afterwards making up the claim, the accusation, that rocks acquired from where exactly, we're talking about the 14th or 15th floor of the hotel, had been thrown from the windows. I had long believed that the site of this incident was actually my room and that the victims were the people I had allowed to sleep there who were still there the next day. But it's possible that the Walker report on the police riot in Chicago actually identified the room as having been my father's. But I've since learned Harold Meyerson, the journalist, was actually a member of the McCarthy staff, the youngest one, 2 years older than myself, and he was on the 15th floor where McCarthy had a room for his younger staff and volunteers. And his head was actually cracked by the police, so he speaks with authority in saying it was not my room, but rather his own, where this occurred. So I yield to Harold on that. He was there, and he got beaten. I wasn't, and I didn't. The next stop was to effect my escape from high school via boat on a ship called the SS Aurelia, which went to Le Havre and delivered me to a year's program in Brittany, the town of Rennes in France, lodging in the friendly home of Yves and Hewitt and their sons, a new family and a language that I have kept for 50 years. It was the fall of 1968, so actually I was not in Paris in May. The revolution had been quelled, but the smell of lacrimogène, of tear gas, was from time to time still in the air. Now, I've mentioned that 1968 was a coming of age year for me, and there was one particular young lady who I'd met over the summer in Israel who drew me to Paris when I could get away. She was the daughter of a butcher and a very fine beauty, perhaps a couple of years older than myself. And luckily for me, we had family friends in Paris. They were Shepherd Stone and his wife, Muzi. Shep had known my parents since their time in New York in the middle 1940s, and he had a place in South Newfane, Vermont, perhaps about 10 miles from the house, from our house, which their daughter, Margaret McDonald, owns to this day. Shep was, I thought, an official of the Ford Foundation. Whether that was his actual job or what one might delicately term non-official cover is something that is still murky in my mind. In any event, he had taken over the Congress for Cultural Freedom when its a CIA sponsorship had been exposed, I think around 1965, in part by my friend Norman Birnbaum, whose papers are here in the Briscoe Center, but decisively by Ramparts magazine. And Shep had rebranded the thing as the International Association for Cultural Freedom, so far as I knew or know, old wine in a new bottle. But what mattered to me, apart from the fact that Shep was the most garrulous semi-secret, semi-official in the history of the United States, and it's not close, by a very, very long margin, he was an unstoppable name dropper whose conversations would be of the form, "The last time I saw Hellman, I told him that Giscard said to me to tell him," that, and so on and so forth. Was the fact that he and his wife, Muzi, had this flat on the sixth floor at number 1 Quai aux Fleurs on the Ile de la Cité, and you can see it behind me in a photograph that I took earlier this year. It's a spectacular location. The apartment had been owned at one point by a fascist literary figure who'd been executed by de Gaulle in 1945. And the essential thing was that it had a maid's room. And the maid's room was off a back corridor and back of the apartment, and they did not have a maid, so that room was always vacant, and I could turn up on a Friday afternoon, coming in by train from Rennes, announced or unannounced, and I had the best place to stay in all of Paris. And so it happened that on a Friday evening, in late October, I appeared at the door. Shep was, as always, gracious and happy to see me, even though I was just a scruffy 16-year-old. And even if I sensed that my manners and my bearing were not always exactly to the liking of his wife, who was a very prim woman of German origin. He was having a party that evening. Would I like to stay? I said, no thanks, I demurred, and I spent the evening uselessly wandering the Latin Quarter. I returned late, Shep was there alone. He was smoking his pipe. He was in an irrepressible mood. Remember, this was 50 years ago, almost today, about the 27th of October, 1968. I remember his words as though he'd just spoken them to me. He said, "You should have been here. Averill was here. Cyrus Vance was here. The war is over." Averill said to me that this was the greatest night of his life. You may imagine the effect of those words on a young anti-war activist high school student, only 15 months away at that point from possible exposure to the draft. The agreement was on the terms of the negotiations, on what the canard enchaîné called la géométrie des tables. The geometric tables, or the tables of geometry, or something like that. The geometry of the tables. The arrangement whereby the U.S. and the Vietnamese would speak to each other. And it collapsed within a few days as the South Vietnamese government rejected the terms. Hubert Humphrey went down to defeat. Richard Nixon was elected, and we learned much later that his campaign, no doubt at his direct authorization through Anna Chenault, had told the government of Vietnam to reject the terms, that they would get a better deal from the Republicans. We know, too, that Lyndon Johnson knew this. He'd had intelligence on the communications of the South Vietnamese embassy, and that he had ordered Walt Rostow to classify the information right here for 75 years. It was winkled out of Walt by, among others, Bob Dalek, in, as I recall, the 1990s. And in 2003, I was present at the LBJ Auditorium when the late, great Ann McAfee, the printer of the Texas Observer, rose to question and to challenge Richard Holbrooke about his knowledge of this issue. It was an astonishing moment. Holbrooke looked at her with an utterly flat expression, and what he said roughly, this is from memory, but a very vivid memory. "You would not believe," he said, "how many hours I have spent on this issue." And for me, as a young member of the negotiating team, to believe that a consultant would betray the process in such a way, to me, that was inconceivable. The consultant, of course, was Henry Kissinger, as you probably know. The remaining months of the year were relatively uneventful, as the rain and the chill of the Brittany winter settled in. I rode my bicycle, I played basketball, I read Jean-Paul Sartre, and I developed a taste for the absurdist theater of Ionesco and Beckett. On one winter evening, again in Paris and coming back to Shep's from a play, I found myself, I think I came out of the metro and found myself with a wall of protesters advancing on one end and a line of Compagnie Républicaine de Sécurité, CRS, on the other, just as the gas grenades started to fly. A policeman, Flick, gave me a hard whack on the upper arm with a rubber truncheon, but it was a measured blow, and I don't think really that he meant to harm me. It was the only violence I experienced personally that year, indeed the only time I've ever been hit by the police. Many others had it worse, both then and later. And I went on to a quiet and uneventful life, even spending half of it, so far, as of this year, precisely half of it, in the warm historical shadow of Lyndon Johnson. If you'd told me this in 1968, I would have said inconceivable. For whom I've developed over the years a measure of understanding and even appreciation that was certainly not accessible to me at the age of 16. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeremy. Question.